Bonjour et bienvenue à la conférence sur les planètes géantes dans la science-fiction. Merci d'être aussi nombreux déjà pour ce début de conférence. Donc, sur ce joli plateau, nous avons Orson Scott Card, qui est connu pour les chroniques d'Alvin Feuzer, qui est aussi connu pour tout l'univers qu'il a construit autour d'Ander, dont une adaptation va bientôt être diffusée en cinéma de la stratégie Ander. Et nous vous remercions de sa présence. Juste à côté, nous avons Norman Spinrad, que nous ne présentons quasiment plus, qui est un éternel habitué des Utopiales, qui a écrit beaucoup et de nombreux romans. Et juste en bout de chaise, nous avons Pierre Bordage et Alain Grousset, qui sont deux grands auteurs francophones de science-fiction et qui, accessoirement, se sont targués d'écrire un diptyque à quatre mains sur une planète qui s'appelle Gigante. Corrigez-moi si je la prononce bien ou gigante. Et nous allons donc commencer par discuter de ces fameuses planètes géantes et plus largement du planète opéra, qui est quand même un genre très présent en science-fiction et qui a eu ses origines dès le début de la science-fiction telle qu'on la nomme, dès le début des années 30. Corrigez-moi si je me trompe ou si ça vous apparaît incongru. Et j'avais tout d'abord une première question pour commencer. Qu'est-ce que pour vous le planète opéra? Qui veut commencer? Pierre?
Moi? Pourquoi?
Je ne sais pas, je vois que tu commences à...
Le planète opéra, qu'est-ce que c'est comme genre, c'est ça?
Pour toi, qu'est-ce que ça symbolise?
Eh bien, ça symbolise la découverte d'un monde nouveau. La possibilité. D'abord, pour moi, c'est un voyage extraordinaire, une planète géante. C'est-à-dire, on va découvrir quelque chose qui est totalement inconnu. On va mettre des personnages dans un univers étrange, souvent différent de la Terre. C'est un petit peu ça son intérêt, de par sa taille, de par son atmosphère, de par tout un tas de choses. Et donc, on va voir comment cette planète et ses caractéristiques influent sur le comportement humain. Et c'est ça l'intérêt. C'est-à-dire, c'est de mettre les humains dans un environnement différents pour voir qu'est-ce que cela change chez les êtres humains. Donc, c'est la confrontation avec l'inconnu qui permet peut-être de mieux étudier ce que c'est que l'humanité, finalement.
Planète Opéra, pour moi, c'est une manière de faire pour un auteur qui a le mal de mer dans les vaisseaux spatiaux. Et au lieu de se faire un space opéra, il fait un planète opéra. C'est-à-dire qu'il ramène absolument tout le monde sur le même lieu. Il n'a plus cette contrainte de déplacement. Au moins dans l'espace. Après, on parle sur la planète, c'est autre chose.
Norman?
Well, it's a tough question. A long time ago, when I was working in a literary agency, a publisher wanted a book to be written called Space Opera. So we got Jack Vance to write the book. Jack Vance, being Jack Vance, he wrote a book about a traveling opera company in outer space. Well, that's... What is a space opera as opposed to straightforward science fiction? Ça, c'est difficile. Je ne connais pas... I don't think it's a question of whether it's an outer space or another planet or not. It's a question of what kind of story it is that makes it a space opera. In a sense, getting back to opera, I suppose, you could say a space opera is just science fiction in a way, as a real opera is to an operetta or a Broadway musical. What that means, I suppose, is that you have larger than life characters and a big story, usually involving a lot of people getting their heads chopped off or shot with ray guns or something like that, as opposed to just a science fiction set on another planet, which doesn't necessarily have to be like that.
I think that really the operative word here is the opera, where the characterizations are not terribly important. It's romantic characterization, so that characters are what they do. And so you're not really worried about deep relationships. What you're worried about in this kind of adventure story is the wonderful things they see, and we discover who they are by the actions that they take. And, of course, usually the hero never hurts anybody on purpose, but will always spring to the defense of the defenseless, and et cetera, et cetera. So we, in traditional space opera, we have a pretty good idea of who our hero is always going to be, how they're going to behave. They follow the rules, same rules as American television heroes. You can never actually kill somebody on purpose. Superman always arrests them and ties them up so that the police can arrest them later. And in a way, it can feel shallow when you prefer deep stories about human relationships, explorations of alien psychology, and so forth. But the truth is, they don't have to be contradictory. You can have a big adventure story that also has wonderful characterization. And then people who don't like your story will call it space opera, and people who do will call it wonderful characterization with good relationships. But there is that old tradition, the golden age of science fiction, where you'll have explanation, you know, the old definition of golden age, which means before Campbell and before we got this really serious science. And I'm afraid that I like the Campbellian better. When we talk about planets, I would much rather have a planet that follows all the rules of science. I don't want Barsoom. I don't even really want Dune, you know, a planet that's all one thing. I think James Blish gave us all good advice when he gave science fiction writers good advice when he said to be careful of, to beware of, the Delaware syndrome. Anyone who knows the United States knows that Delaware is probably the single most boring state. It's very small. It progresses from low hills down to a river, the tidal river, and he says, James Blish says, beware of creating planets that have as much variety as the state of Delaware. And even Larry Niven's Ringworld, which is huge, and of course Larry created it brilliantly, but because it's a narrow band, well, narrow, huge band, but in astronomical terms, narrow band, that is all exactly the same distance from the sun, there's actually less variety of climate in Ringworld than you would find in a rocky planet like Earth. So I think that when I care about world creation, I'm not really talking about the space opera things, the big adventure story. I'm thinking, how good is this world? How believable is the world creation?
Well, just an aside to the previous thing, which is, I think it's fair to say that what makes a space opera a space opera is that it's a romantic story. Now, to define romantic story might take us quite a while, so I don't think we should really get into that. But in general, I could say a space opera is Baroque science fiction. Now, we can we can try and define Baroque for a while. So I'll get off that. I think the thing, I have never built a big planet. They're all the same size, I don't know. Because actually, a planet, well, Bob Silverberg did this, was the only person who really dealt with this correctly, with Majapur, which is a very large planet. Now, if you have a very large planet with the same, more or less, inner geology as the Earth, the gravity is going to be so bad that you just be crawling around on your stomach, if at all. So what Bob did with Majapur is made it mineral-starved. And that had a lot of consequences to the stories. So I have done two or three planets, I suppose, not many. One was Pacifica. And there I wanted to... I needed a planet in which I could set a sort of utopia, political utopia, that would work on this planet. But in order to do that, I had to have a certain kind of geology, and it had to be a fairly recent colony so it should be rich with a small population. With other things, in a way, you could even say with Blue Common Orange, with the planet happens to be a future Earth, but you design. But I had to figure out, as you say, different parts of the planet will be enhanced by a climate change. Other parts will be losers. Which part is which? Which part is that? Which culture survives in which part, and what it contains. I think you can contrast this kind of planet building with, say, Jack Vance's Big World, Big Planet, which is a huge planet, which basically it's not very scientifically accurate. Anything can happen there. It's a kind of fantasy that allowed Vance, who has terrific Baroque style, to free himself to write that sort of thing where the whole planet is like that. But on the other hand, the cultures are very different, and the geography is very different, depending on what kind of story Vance wanted to write. He did the same thing with The Dying Earth, which happened to be the far future Earth. So for me, to the extent that I've done this sort of thing, I start with the story I want to tell and the kind of culture I want, and then I try and figure out on what sort of planet would these cultures arise rather than the other way around.
J'avais une question pour Pierre et Alain. D'où est né le projet Gigante? Comment vous avez créé cette fameuse planète et comment ça s'est construit et comment on est venu l'idée en fait, toute première?
D'abord, c'est Alain qui était l'instigateur du projet puisqu'il a voulu travailler avec moi et qu'on est parti sur un planète opéra. Ensuite, on voulait une planète extraordinaire sur tous les plans, donc par sa taille. Et donc, nous nous sommes totalement affranchis de la plausibilité scientifique en essayant plutôt de gagner une plausibilité romanesque parce que, évidemment, si on fait un space opéra ou si on fait un planète opéra, on est déjà affranchi de la plausibilité scientifique puisqu'on ne peut pas là, théoriquement le faire pour l'instant. Donc, notre planète est une exception qui n'a pas encore été trouvée mais qu'on ne saurait tarder à trouver. Je pense que l'univers est plein de merveilles que nous ne connaissons pas toutes, et que donc nous avons une très très grande liberté finalement en tant qu'auteur d'imaginer des choses extravagantes qui s'affranchissent justement de cette plausibilité qui est emprisonnante finalement, parce que on avait une conférence hier avec Roland Louk, il a chapé le moral de tout le monde en disant les voyages dans l'espace c'est pas possible, ça coûte trop cher d'envoyer un humain dans l'espace, il faut de l'oxygène, il faut de la nourriture, il faut de la... Donc on s'affranchit de tout ça. Ce qui nous intéresse à nous, c'est de travailler, enfin moi personnellement, Alain pourra peut-être dire autre chose, c'est de travailler le ressenti du personnage par rapport au monde qu'il fréquente. C'est ça qui m'intéresse moi en tant qu'auteur, puisqu'évidemment en tant que romancier je suis je m'intéresse aux personnages, ce sont les personnages qui font le roman, c'est de les mettre dans cet univers là et voir comment l'univers va influer sur leur vie, ou comment ça va modifier, ou comment eux ils vont s'adapter, enfin quelle civilisation va se créer par rapport aux conditions à la fois climatiques, à la gravité, enfin tous les problèmes qui se posent, à la raréfaction de la nourriture. Enfin, quand vous êtes sur une planète inconnue, vous avez tout un tas de problèmes à résoudre. Et donc, voilà, c'est ça qui m'intéresse, c'est l'humain sur ce monde-là. Parce qu'un monde, à mon sens, et là, je ne sais pas si Alain est d'accord avec ça non plus, mais à mon sens, l'univers n'a d'intérêt que pour le regard qu'on lui porte. Et si on n'a pas de regard sur cette planète, elle n'existe tout simplement pas.
Moi, l'idée m'est venue en regardant mon ventre. Je me dis, tiens, une planète géante, pourquoi? J'ai déjà ça sur moi. Non, l'intérêt, c'était effectivement de nous laisser un maximum de liberté et dans l'inventivité. C'est ce qui nous plaît en tant qu'auteur. On a notre petite minute de gloire lorsqu'on écrit. C'est au moment où on invente, on est les dieux, on distribue les cartes au début. Donc 1% d'inspiration, puis après 99% de transpiration. Donc ce moment de 1 là est très très jouissif. Et cette planète géante nous permettait aussi d'en avoir d'apport de sociétés, de micro-sociétés qui fuient pour X raisons, de politique, sociale et tout, et s'installent sur cette planète géante en étant vraiment en toute liberté, sans avoir des gens autour qui vont influer sur leur devenir, utopique ou pas, de leur société. Donc ça, on avait ce maximum de liberté, donc ça nous permettait de pouvoir démarrer convenablement.
Et puis surtout, le gigantisme de la planète nous permettait de travailler sur une échelle de temps tout à fait différente, puisque sur notre planète, il faut 100 ans, hein, c'est ça ? Un siècle, pardon ?
Un siècle pour faire le tour.
Un avion pour en faire le tour, ce qui change complètement les perspectives, et que chaque fois qu'on part en voyage sur ce monde, on n'est jamais certain de revenir. Et c'était ça aussi l'intérêt. Moi, j'avais pour en tête l'émigration aux États-Unis. Ces Européens qui partaient vers cette terre immense sur une autre échelle, qui partaient pour un voyage sans retour. Et là, c'est simplement à multiplier par des milliers de fois, parce que non seulement il y a le voyage pour aller sur la planète qui interdit tout retour, mais le voyage sur la planète elle-même interdit aussi tout retour. Donc voilà, et là, on a des sentiments qui sont très forts de la part des êtres humains, parce qu'ils doivent vivre avec ça en permanence, quoi.
On connaît les arches stellaires, et là, on arrive à faire des sociétés qui sont dans un voyage générationnel, mais sur la Terre. Ça, c'est aussi un sujet qui nous plaisait bien.
D'accord. J'avais une autre question à vous quatre. Quand vous décidez de créer une planète, est-ce que la cartographie vous vient naturellement ou vous laissez des espaces de vide qui vous permettent par la suite d'être comblés par l'histoire d'un point de vue totalement de l'écriture ?
Well, when I map a world, I do work with maps a lot. That's really where I start. I always start with a planet very much like Earth. That solves a lot of problems just to start with. And then I start creating maps. But I had the advantage over somebody like, say, J.R.R. Tolkien, that I grew up as climate science and as plate tectonics came to be understood much better, so that I know where you can't put a forest. Tolkien's map of Middle-earth has impossible forests. You just can't imagine wind patterns that would ever bring moisture to these places. They're obviously deserts. They would be deserts, depending on their latitude and so on. But that's okay. He didn't know. The science wasn't there yet. But it's a pleasure to work with a map and then start saying, okay, if this land is highland, what would be behind it? And then I work with the terrain, and if it's interesting, I set a story there. And if it's not interesting, I find the map years later when I'm cleaning that portion of my closet. So, I love working with maps. But what I find really interesting in most, especially film science fiction, Star Trek, Star Wars, they take lands that basically they have whole planets that are about as interesting as a county. So they're just round counties, basically. And so the ocean, the space functions the way ocean. I studied medieval romance in college, and I found that you could take all these medieval romances, and if you change the ocean to space, it would work as Star Trek episodes, or fit into Star Wars, so that you have a desert planet, and you have an ice planet. Well, how would creatures evolve on an ice planet? How would there even be an atmosphere on a desert planet, since it takes oceanic bacteria to change a reducing atmosphere into a CO2 and oxygen and nitrogen atmosphere? I mean, without life, there's no atmosphere, and without water, there's no life, and so forth. So, absurd ideas, but what they're really doing is just telling stories set on Earth, except they're using spaceships instead of boats to get from one place to another. So they really don't care at all. So in a way, that's what you're talking about with Gigant, this is a world where you're not even worried about whether a real planet could work this way. What you're doing is having huge amounts of space to explore, that there's always going to be a different culture. So Star Trek could have taken place entirely on your world, and it would actually have been more realistic.
Well, I agree with most of what you just said, except for one thing, which is a gigantic one thing. Because we don't know what would happen to a desert planet. We are spending a lot of money and having a lot of effort spent to explore this question on Mars. And we don't have an answer yet. This is the golden age of astronomy. This is going to make this sort of thing much more complicated to do correctly, but much more variable and with many more opportunities, because it turns out, when I was a kid, I got my first astronomy book, and supposedly the solar system was created by a near miss of another star at ours, so So solar systems were very rare. And it turns out nothing could be further from the truth, that there are probably more planets than stars, that there are planets floating, or planetoid bodies, asteroids, whatever you want to call them, floating between the so-called empty interstellar space between here and Alpha Centauri. None of that is true. All that we know, that we thought we knew, was wrong, was small. We found, for instance, even before that, that there were ecologies existing in the ocean depths that did not run on photosynthesis at all, did not require light. So I think it's really too early to say where life can or cannot arise. I find this very, very exciting. It opens up a whole new vista that I think science fiction has yet to explore, and I can't say I've done it myself yet. But this is certainly, the last 10 years or so, the most revolutionary period in the history of astronomy. Our knowledge is going by quantum leaps, one after the other. And it's certainly true that a lot of this science fiction that has been written does, in fact, it's like a simple, it's Dune. We're going to see, if anybody wants to see this, there's going to be a documentary on the Jodorowsky attempt to do Dune. It'd be interesting that was like, because when I saw these guys on Dune, on this desert planet, running around in rubber suits, something was wrong, and it sort of went from there. I think we're approaching a whole new ocean, literally, of subject matter of this sort of thing, about what worlds really are. And that's very exciting, because we don't know yet. What we know, and know more of it than we did, is that what is possible as a domain of life is much more broad than we thought it was. And what we really know is more possibilities, and we don't really know what is impossible.
Oui, ça se rejoint à ce que je disais tout à l'heure, hein, et c'est pourquoi il faut s'affranchir des contraintes de l'emprisonnement scientifique, parce que c'est le rôle des auteurs d'explorer d'autres voies, justement. Puisque l'infini des possibles est très très... Enfin, les possibles sont infinis, et donc ça nous appartient à nous, auteurs, qui ne sommes pas contraints par des résultats ou de la plausibilité, d'explorer de nouvelles voies.
Oui, je crois que là, on est vraiment dans la dualité de la science-fiction, entre la hard science et puis le reste. Et moi, je ne me classe pas du tout dans la hard science, et je pense que la hard science est bénéfique par certains écrits, indéniablement, mais il est assez, c'est une science-fiction assez de proximité. 20 ans après, tout est balayé. Alors que si on parle sur sur l'homme, c'est ce qu'on essaye de faire, de mettre au centre et de jouer en rat de laboratoire, en le mettant dans des conditions très spéciales et puis voir ce qu'il fait, parce que l'homme a cette faculté d'adaptation extraordinaire. C'est ça qui nous intéresse vraiment pour voir. Et je pense que ces écrits-là peuvent rester plus longtemps dans l'imagination et pour le lecteur, je pense.
Est-ce que vous pensez, en faisant justement la contradiction entre art science et plutôt anthropologie d'écriture, que les sociétés qui sont dépeintes sur ces planètes ont forcément un message politique ou sociétal qui doit les caractériser?
En tout cas, c'est une expérimentation, ce qui permet d'expérimenter d'autres formes de société, d'autres formes de relations à la nature. À ce titre-là, c'est très intéressant de placer une colonie humaine sur un monde spécifique pour voir comment il évolue. Ça, c'est vraiment le centre même d'un planète opéra, à mon avis. C'était assez remarquable dans Une planète nommée Trahison de Scott, où on a ces personnages étranges dont les membres s'hypertrophient ou s'atrophient, etc. Enfin, où il y a une influence de l'environnement sur les personnages et sur leur comportement.
Yeah, I mean, political culture an economic culture, which is sort of part of the same thing, is really, I would say, completely determined by natural resource questions and ecology, but certainly heavily influenced. A country like the United States, or for that matter, France, which has a certain geological and climatological character, is inherently a rich country because it can grow its food. There are countries like Somalia or in the Sahel which don't have that base. And that, I think, really affects the consciousness of the characters, certainly the societies. It circumscribes the economic possibilities, which in turn creates a local politic and a local culture. Now, I don't know why this is true, but it's an old saying that religions start in the desert. And if you look at it, it seems to be true. You have Christianity and Islam and so forth, the rising out of a desert culture. And you have California. But seriously, with all these cults, where do they all come from? They come from California. And they arise from desert. The peyote religions of Mexico also come from the desert part of Mexico for the most part. There's something about that environment that has a profound effect on what kind of people arise there. I mean, in one way, that's where Dune went right. Okay, if you have a desert planet, this is what you're going to end up with really a native society that's adapted to the facts, and then a colonial society which is trying to co-opt it and take it over and has ecological and cultural reasons why, in the end, it's probably not going to work.
When we talk about hard science rules and you want to cut free of them, that's great because when you're starting to create something, you can create whatever you want, call it fantasy, call it science fiction, find whatever rules you want. That's the freedom the writer has at the beginning of the process. But it's almost impossible to tell an interesting story until you have set up new rules of your own. Whatever your rules are, whatever rules your world is going to follow, once you lay, as you said, once you deal out the cards, once you set it up the way it's supposed to be, then you follow your own rules. And the odd thing, when I teach writing, I demonstrate this with my students, is that the stories get more interesting the more rules you have. When anything can happen, who cares what happens? But once you know that it works exactly this way, that this causes this and this and this, and these things must be caused by those things, then you start finding how the society would be changed by it. You start finding which people profit most, which people lose the most, who suffers, who gains. And all of those rules, both of the society and of the world, open up story possibilities. Every time you say you can't do this, then you, of course, create a character who wants to do that, to do the thing that he can't do. And it's out of the frustration and the limitations that the stories all arise. So we're free as writers to start with a blank slate and set up whatever rules we want. But as readers, when we come into a world, we spend our time discovering the rules that the writer has created for these characters to live with.
Yeah, that's very good. That's very true. And it certainly applies to fantasy as well. If anything can happen, then anything can happen. There's a lot of fantasy that doesn't have rules, and it really can't be very good. There was a movement in mainly coming out of England, but then expanding to the States, about so-called postmodern space opera. And postmodern space opera is really fantasy in science fiction clothing. And that knows that it's that, and so can change all the rules arbitrarily or like that, or just use space opera rules, or do use no rules at all. It is possible though not very easy, I think, to actually write that kind of fiction in which the rules keep changing. The reality keeps changing. But this is not science fiction, and it's not conventional space opera either. It's fiction that knows that it's fiction, that admits that it's fiction. It's a story. I'm telling a story. Whatever I want to happen will happen. It's my story. And then it's totally dependent on the story. And I think a good pre-postmodern version of this, in a way, was everything that Jack Vance ever wrote, practically. And I really like what Jack Vance wrote. He wanted to do it. He did it. Jack was not a scientific ignoramus. He just wanted to write what he wanted to write and make it work like that. And I think you do have some rare writers who can do that sort of thing one way or another. I've even just one myself, which is Welcome to Your Dreamtime, Le Temps de Rêve. Okay, so the whole thing takes place within dreams. Well, if that's the premise, I can do anything I want with these dreams within that premise. Chaos can be a premise too, but it's not usually done that way.
Another example, besides Jack Vance, is Ray Bradbury's Martian Chronicles. His Mars, when he wrote that, right, he already knew, everyone already knew, that it could not possibly happen with what we knew about Mars. He didn't care. He set up his Mars. It was a very... I don't want to say it was dreamlike, because he did follow rules, but it was sort of a nostalgic Mars. It was the Mars we wish we could have had. So he was building it on kind of what if Barsoom had been possible.
He didn't even do that, Scott, because people forget that Martian Chronicles is a collection of short stories. And if you look at the stories, it's not the same Mars in all the stories. Right. He just does what he wants. At different times. They're written over a fairly long period of time.
He strung it all together into a book, but you're right. It's like October Country. It's basically Bradbury. He's a short story writer. So any book that he does is kind of a fake, in the sense that it wasn't really meant to be a novel. It's just a little smoke and mirrors to make you feel like they all belong together, because he wrote each story separately.
Oui, je voulais revenir sur ce que disait Scott tout à l'heure, sur la page blanche. J'écris avec une page blanche. C'est une grande différence entre Alain et moi dans la façon de travailler. Mais je suis d'accord avec lui sur le fait que plus on s'éloigne dans l'imaginaire et plus on a besoin de rigueur, parce que la construction imaginaire doit tenir d'une façon ou d'une autre. Mais moi, ce que je fais, c'est que je n'écris pas sur un papier avant comment va être mon monde, je ne cartographie pas, je le découvre avec mes personnages. Et c'est ce monde-là qui est en train de se créer par l'écriture, finalement, c'est ma façon de travailler. C'est le monde qui est en train de se travailler par l'écriture qui m'impose ses propres règles. Vous voyez, moi, mes personnages, c'est mon vaisseau d'exploration. Je découvre le monde avec eux, et ce monde impose peu à peu ses règles, sa propre logique et sa propre rigueur à mes personnages. Donc après, j'essaie de faire confiance à ce qui se passe, n'ayant pas ni de cartographie, ni de fiches, ni de scénario préconçu. Et on pourra en parler avec Alain, parce qu'Alain, il a exactement la façon inverse de travailler de moi, ce qui pose un certain nombre de problèmes. Mais c'est ma façon de travailler. Moi, si je fais une cartographie avant, si je fais un scénario avant, si je fais des fiches avant, je épuise le livre. C'est-à-dire que ça ne m'intéresse plus d'écrire le livre.
Oui, effectivement, Pierre est un scripturant, c'est-à-dire tout lui vient au moment de l'écriture. Et moi, je suis un structurant. Il faut déjà que tout soit fait dans ma tête avant de démarrer. Donc, il y avait un rituel. Chaque matin, je l'appelais, puisqu'on écrivait chacun notre histoire en même temps, pour une histoire de calendrier. Bien sûr, l'idéal, ça aurait été que Pierre ait fini et que moi, je puisse avoir à disposition son manuscrit, puisque moi, mon histoire se passe 20 ans après la sienne. Et donc, tous les matins, à 8 heures, je l'appelais pour me demander des renseignements, et invariablement, il dit « je sais pas ». C'était ça le matin, « je sais pas ». C'est pas qu'il voulait m'enfoncer, mais alors donc, j'étais un peu mal de temps en temps. Je voudrais juste dire à Norman que les religions, pour moi, ne si elles naissent dans le désert, c'est à cause de la chaleur, parce qu'il n'y a pas vraiment de grandes religions inuites, et pourtant ils sont aussi dans le désert, mais blancs. Donc c'est la chaleur, certainement.
I think that what we may have, be able to say is that deserts that conquer other people and impose their religion on other people come from the desert because the people who live there are so eager to get away and get to where the water is. It's just a joke. Everybody has a religion. There is no culture without a religion. And so, even today, I watch people who call themselves atheists and see that they are just as fanatical in spreading their beliefs, or can be, as people who were proselytizing in the name of a god. So, it's part of the human impulse that we find belief wherever we are. But getting the two of you with your opposite ways of working, I actually do both of those things, which is I have to have it completely planned out, and then I never look at my outline again. And I make up stuff as I go along, but I still have that outline in the back of my mind. So I agree with both of you that that's the perfect way to work.
C'est un parachute. Vous avez un parachute, quoi. Vous avez déjà votre cadre.
Ouais. J'avais une question plus large qui ne concerne pas votre travail directement. Mais pour vous, quelle planète symbolise le mieux le planète opéra, quelle est la planète la plus mythique pour vous personnellement et surtout pourquoi?
Pour moi, c'est Dune, incontestablement. C'est le bouquin qui m'a vraiment poussé presque à l'écriture parce que j'y trouvais beaucoup de choses. Bon, il y a le désert dont parle Norman, il y avait cette espèce de mystique qui m'intéressait beaucoup aussi, qui était la relation d'un peuple à son environnement et la façon dont il surmonte cet environnement et donc crée une mythologie par rapport à cet environnement. Il y a les histoires de pouvoir, il y a les histoires de société, il y a l'adaptation fabuleuse des personnages au désert avec leurs appareils qui leur permettent de récupérer l'eau de leur propre corps et ce genre de choses. Donc il a poussé le concept très loin avec une connaissance écologique très très importante et une logique assez imparable, cette histoire-là, plus des personnages qui sont aussi déchirés, qui sont toujours écartelés entre devoir et passion. Et donc pour moi, vraiment, Dune est l'exemple type du Planet Opera.
Oui, alors Dune, bien entendu. Alors il faut que je trouve quelque chose d'autre. Je penserais pas une planète, mais le cycle d'Omal de Laurent Genefort avec cette sphère de Dyson qui, elle aussi, est absolument gigantesque. Et l'intérêt d'avoir du gigantisme aussi, je pense, c'est aussi l'apport de races extraterrestres que l'on peut faire arriver. Et là, Laurent a fait ça absolument superbement. Et moi, je me régale à lire le cycle d'Omal et je le conseille à tout le monde.
Norman?
I don't know if I have an answer to that.
Plusieurs?
I work from outlines. I sometimes work from very long outlines, very detailed outlines. And I think this came from writing screenplays, where you have to do that. I never start a novel, or for the most part, that part of a short story, without knowing what the ending is going to be. I know where I'm going, and I know where I'm starting from, and I have a default middle. But if it's going well, sometimes characters take over. They say, "No, I'm not going to do that. That's not me. No, you can't make me do that. You better figure something. I'm not going to do it." In a book I just Police State, which is the last thing I wrote, there was a character who was supposed to be a walk-on, but he wouldn't walk off, and took over big parts of the book. You know, and made it better. I think there is always a creative tension between, pre-designed control and spontaneous inspiration when you're writing. The danger being, and I speak now as a critic who reads a lot of failed books, especially in science fiction, and almost all of them fail because the ending fails. The writer gets to a certain point and doesn't know what to do and makes up some bullshit. The most horrible example of this, mine, I happen to know this, is Kubrick's 2001. Because Arthur told me this, that what they wanted to do at the end of that movie was bring beautiful aliens onto the screen. And they tried, and they tried, and they tried. They couldn't do it. So they made up the Space Child and then all those Baroque rooms. It made no sense, really, because they were stuck. And they had to finish the movie. I think that happens more often than certainly we would like, and more often, you know, you the writer often will just write themselves into a one-way street, and they can't get out of it, so they make up some stuff like that. That is why, even when I've had books or that I wanted to write, I knew what the theme was, I had some characters, stuff like that. But I wouldn't start the thing until I had an outline that satisfied me that I knew where I was going in the end.
I could not agree more. I mean, if you don't know the ending, you have no idea where to begin, because a good structured novel or story promises the ending you're going to deliver. It doesn't tell you what the ending is going to be, but it starts out with dilemmas and problems that can only be solved by the ending you're going to head for. And I've started a few stories without knowing the ending, and they have my most cliched endings, I have to say, because you get a little desperate at the end. So I'm with you, Norman. You have to know your ending before you can start. You know, when you talk about Dune as being the perfect planet story, what we're really talking about is not planet story, but a place story, a story about a place. Because I've known other novels like that, even outside of science fiction, where we're really exploring this place. And the very flaws of Dune as a planet make it really useful as this kind of place-centered story, milieu-centered story, because it really is all one thing. And so you're really only exploring one culture, and you can really concentrate in on it and bear down on it. When you're talking about something that has huge amounts of variety, then it really can't be about place. It's going to be about many places, and it doesn't have that sharp focus that Dune has because, ecologically speaking, it's so limited and small.
And doesn't make any sense. In a way, if you look outside the science fiction and fantasy, you see, in a way, what you're talking about is the regional novel, right? Somebody could probably write a good novel about Delaware, I would imagine. Yeah. It would have to do with all those corporations that are...
They have to keep going to Trenton, you know.
Or something like that. The Southern the Southern Regional is a major American form. I just wrote one.
And how many New York City novels are there?
Zillions. Zillions. I just reviewed a novel that came out. Was written... It wasn't just a New York City novel. It was written... About 10 blocks of the Upper West Side around Columbia University and the culture of that neighborhood. And it was a fantasy novel. Wasn't that good? How many things have been written about Paris? The Woody Allen movie, a great movie. I thought I really loved that movie, Midnight in Paris. So I think you can have a great big planet and still write a regional. You can have the planet in your head when you start to write, but then you focus in on a region that you accept as a region, and maybe there are some outside influences filtering in, but basically you can write a regional that way too.
Well, even with Gigant, don't you visit one culture at a time, one place at a time, and get to know that place for a little while before you move on?
C'est-à-dire que le principe du voyage... Enfin, Gigante, c'est aussi la découverte d'un moyen de transport tout à fait extravagant, extraordinaire, par un des personnages qui permet de vaincre le problème de la planète qui est celui des déplacements. En fait, après, il rencontre effectivement plusieurs cultures différentes au fur et à mesure de ses voyages, mais effectivement qui sont localisées dans un endroit précis. Alain lui a imaginé une culture de bateaux qui remonte un fleuve gigantesque. Après, il y a des gens qui se sont installés dans un endroit et qui ont créé un type de culture, et d'autres un autre type de culture, etc. Mais effectivement, on rencontre des tribus et s'aimer sur le monde. Donc il y a une découverte de différents types de populations qui est liée au gigantisme de la planète. Quoi. Et aussi différents types de lieux, différents types de paysages, de déserts, de forêts. On a par exemple un univers de lacs de gélat verte, c'est une sorte de substance pétrolifère qui permet de nourrir les moteurs, d'alimenter les moteurs des machines, enfin, etc. Il y a des paysages très différents. Mais il y a aussi, c'est aussi, je pense, Gigante, même si c'est un planète opéra, c'est aussi un roman de voyage. On découvre énormément, on bouge beaucoup. C'est un road movie planétaire plus qu'une étude de planétaire. Je ne sais pas si Alain est d'accord avec ça.
Si, je pense qu'il faut essayer, dans chaque livre, pour que ça marche bien, il faut essayer de mettre trois choses. Un voyage géographique, un voyage technologique et un voyage initiatique. Si vous arrivez à mettre ça dans les trois en même temps, vous arrivez à faire quelque chose de pas trop mal. Et puis finalement, donc un planète opéra, si ça a un succès, après on peut en faire 15 volumes à l'intérieur. C'est déjà bien, notre monde est déjà en place. Mais bon, ce n'était pas l'objectif.
Vulgar, approchant de la fin de conférence, et vu que vous êtes nombreux, est-ce qu'il y a des questions parmi le public?
Oui. Alors oui, ce que je me disais, mais c'est que finalement, la planète géante, c'est surtout dans le cadre où moi j'ai l'impression, enfin en tout cas dans le cadre du livre Gigante, c'est surtout que j'ai l'impression que c'est un personnage finalement. Alors que dans d'autres space opéra où on va passer d'une situation où les planètes ne sont que prétexte à une situation, que ce soit un désert ou une planète de glace, là j'ai l'impression surtout que la planète, elle joue un rôle de personnage. Donc finalement, je ne sais pas si la taille était si importante, enfin, parce que là, ça fait partie de sa personnalité, mais je pense qu'on pourrait peut-être imaginer une planète plus petite qui aurait autant de personnalité et autant de caractéristiques.
Oui, mais là, elle a de la personnalité et elle est grande, en plus.
Oui, non, mais voilà, on est d'accord, mais je trouve que c'est parce qu'on décide de faire de la planète un acteur réel du livre.
Mais son gigantisme, elle fait partie vraiment de son caractère, dans le sens où elle impose aux êtres humains qui voyagent dessus tout un tas de règles nouvelles qui les obligent soit à se dépasser, soit à inventer en permanence, à s'adapter. Ce qu'on voulait, c'était vraiment un monde qui soit extrêmement difficile à maîtriser. Puis en plus, elle a des colères électriques tout à fait particulières qui s'abattent sur toute la surface. Donc un monde extrêmement dangereux qui peut tuer à tout moment et qui oblige les humains à faire preuve d'inventivité et c'est ce que fait le personnage de Zaslo Mertikant lorsqu'il arrive sur la planète, c'est d'essayer de découvrir les mécanismes secrets de la planète, pourquoi elle est comme ça, comment elle fonctionne. Et donc, oui, effectivement, elle est un personnage. Au même titre que la mer Méditerranée pour Ulysse ou dans le voyage de l'Odyssée, tout ça. Elle est un vrai personnage, quoi.
Oui, son gigantisme a influé sur notre histoire. Ça, c'est indéniable. Ça aurait été une planète tout à fait normale. On passait à côté de certaines choses. Par exemple, donc les migrants qui sont très riches se payent un vaisseau qu'ils écrasent sur la planète, donc ils ne peuvent plus repartir, mais ils se servent de ce vaisseau comme matière première, ils ont tout amené. Et les gens les plus pauvres arrivent tous à un astroport et là doivent aller rejoindre leur lieu qui leur a été distribué de colonies. Et là, d'un seul coup, se met en place un voyage générationnel. Donc le gigantisme là, influençait sur nos personnages.
I'm not sure I understand the question, but it just occurred to me listening to that, you know, in a way, all of human history on this planet is the story of various first contacts of different civilizations, for better or for worse, usually for worse, and so much space opera is the same thing. It's almost it's a template for terrestrial history that to a large extent really is extended out into science fiction. It's the same model at being Western stuff. This kind of science fiction, it tends to have a colonial or neo-colonial model all the way through, to, at least to some extent. And our history as a species on this planet, if you're looking for a generality of it, is that it's either first contact or second contact, the clash of civilizations, the merging of civilizations, the exfoliating of civilizations. That seems to be what we do as a species, and maybe unconsciously even, we really tend to do that in our speculative fiction of any kind. Certainly fantasy is almost all of that. I mean, Tolkien is all that. I mean, you know, you got the trolls, and you got orcs, and you have hobbits, and all that stuff. You see the same thing in Star Wars. You see the same thing. I mean, I wrote a book called Mexico, which is a historical about, you know, the Spaniards and the Aztecs coming into first contact with each other. It's almost, if you're writing about more than one civilization, where there's a human civilization and an alien civilization, or two alien civilizations, or a human civilization and an alien civilization, you tend to get that. And unfortunately, I think, at least 9 times out of 10, the initial contact, and maybe the continual contact, tends to not come out too well. There's a winner and there's a loser.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned Tolkien with orcs, because I always think of orcs as the prototypical video game bad guys. They just keep spawning and spawning, but it's always okay to kill them. There's no moral force involved here. You can always kill an orc. That's okay. You know, it's that, as you're saying, Norman, that's kind of the story of the human race, is that no matter what we do, no matter where we go, everybody always finds their orcs, people that it's okay to kill or destroy, or you know, you can say anything you want bad about an orc, it's okay, because they're not really people. Keep defining certain groups as orcs.
Well, you have the same thing in Star Wars. One of the things I don't like about the Star Wars thing is it's okay to kill these, you know, these star troopers of the Empire because you don't even, they are literally faceless. It's okay to kill them. You know, every time the United States has gotten into a war in the last, I don't know, 100 years or more, we always make up some nasty epithet name for the enemy, whether they're dinks or slopes or
everybody
or
does.
Nips. Well, I don't know if everybody probably does. Yeah, but sometimes they're worse than others. You have to depersonalize your foe, and maybe that's not the worst thing though. Because, here's another story. What if you didn't? What if you had a culture that didn't depersonalize that enjoyed it, that enjoyed killing real conscious beings that weren't like themselves for that, you know, for the fun of it or something like that? I don't know if that's been written, but I do think it's possible, and I think that might be worse.
And now I want to read your story. I want to read it. I want to read it. But talking about a planet as a character, I really am leery of having characters until there's somebody with a will that is trying to do something. And so I would never call a planet a character, but think of it more as being, when you go out and play golf, which I've never done, but I've seen it done, golf, it's you against the course. It doesn't matter who else is playing with you. It's you against the course and whatever weather you have at that time. Now, there is an intelligent designer who set up the course and built up obstacles. It's like a video game. Video game designers are all golf course designers. And you come in and you play on their course. And so it feels like you against the course, and it's a war between with the course. And the course can start to feel like it's a character. Look what it's done to me now. But it's not alive. Only you're alive. And that distinction between character and inanimate set of obstacles, I think, is a good one for us to always preserve, the difference.
Il est exactement 15 heures. Au vu des plannings chargés aujourd'hui en conférence qui ont l'air fort intéressantes, on vous souhaite une bonne journée. On espère que vous avez apprécié cette conférence.